The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There are all kinds of things that we rely on for their legitimacy, for you guys to do them. Principles that aren't really very neutral. And I think this is, I'm not making any apologies for that, by the way. But I think it is the tectonic level of what gives rise to this very deep mistrust. A friend of mine at CIA joked to me once that if it were legal under local law for us to do it, you wouldn't need to have a CIA. That's what the State Department is for. And I think, you know, that's an interesting statement about why we have clandestine intelligence services. And it's a little bit hard conceptually to reconcile. Not impossible, but it's a little bit tricky to reconcile with the idea of constitutions based on neutral principles.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 21st, 2014. That was Benjamin Wittes you just heard, editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Back in mid-September, Ben delivered a keynote address on Constitution Day at the National Security Agency, which we can now provide to you in full. That's right. It took this long for an unclassified speech from someone without a security clearance to pass through the declassification process. To that point, Ben's address touches on the difficulties of transparency in intelligence operations, outlines just why so many people now struggle to trust the intelligence community, and concludes with three challenges the community must address in order to maintain public confidence in the future. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 111, Benjamin Wittes, Constitution Day at the NSA.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks to Raj and John for those extravagantly kind introductions. Just want to start by saying how moved I am to be here. There's sort of no in the line of work that I'm in, which is it's a funny line of work, right? Which is we sit outside of policymaking circles and we kind of throw grapes. And sometimes we try to make suggestions and sometimes more often we make criticisms or complaints or suggestions that if, you know, ideas that we had some years back had only been listened to, everything would be different, which, you know, is always unprovable, of course, which is what makes it fun to say. There's nothing that we do that, when we're doing our jobs well, isn't meant to be useful to people like you. And we sometimes forget that, you know, the job of people who comment on policy and engage with policy is ultimately to enhance policy, to make it better, to make it work better. And, you know, for the opportunity to come chat with you all at a time that is, you know, you guys know better than I do, of some stress in this agency, with a certain amount of unwanted publicity for the agency is moving to me, and I'm delighted to be here and hope we can have a useful and interesting exchange. You know, people should feel free to, I'm going to talk for a little while, but as, you know, as you have thoughts, there are microphones on the side, and please feel free to interrupt me and go in the direction that you might want to go. Constitution Day is an odd day. It's a weird event. It exists the way it does largely because of Robert Byrd, who wrote into an appropriations rider a number of years ago that every institution, and I think every federal agency as well, every educational institution that gets federal money must have a Constitution Day observance. Now, if you're a major university, this is not a big problem because, you know, you have a law school and you have people who teach constitutional law. But if you're a small college, this is actually a little bit of a problem because you may not have resources to have, in personnel resources, that is, to have a particular Constitution Day observance. And this makes, I'm sure Bob Byrd did not mean to do this when he created this, you know, unfunded mandate on every small liberal arts college in the country, an incredible racket for people like me, who right around this time of year find that we are really, you know, that there's these little colleges that just really want to hear from us. So the other day I was at Kenyon College giving their statutorily required Constitution Day talk. And I was at a faculty dinner with the political, you know, mostly political science faculty. And one of them said, are you doing any other Constitution Day events? And I said, well, yes, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be at the National Archive talking about the future of the Constitution. And the day after that, I'm going to be the Constitution Day speaker at NSA. And there was this, you know, taken aback pause. And then one of the professors says, well, they really need it. So I had my, my initial instinct was to sort of get my back up and to say some of the things that, you know, that Raj just said about, you know, sort of the way the Constitution affects kind of everything that goes on there. And can you imagine what that agency could do given its capabilities if it were not cognizant of constitutional restraints and the statutory restraints that are layered on top of that under the Constitution? And I went through a sort of trope that I won't repeat along those lines that would be familiar to a lot of you. But I was thinking as I was saying this, why is this level of suspicion the kind of thing that that was a perfectly normal and unremarkable thing for a political scientist to say at such a dinner, not in a joking sense. It was said in a good-natured way, but it was not a joke. And why is there this kind of baseline level of suspicion that, you know, that would be a very predictable thing? I've had that conversation, you know, 1,500 times in the last year and a half, and most of you, I'm sure, have had it many more than that. And so I was thinking about the various possible answers to this question that get floated around, you know, whenever you say, well, why are people so suspicious of the intelligence community? And and particularly of NSA. And I was thinking about how inadequate I think they are as analytic explanations for the suspicion. So I just want to tick through them, though I jotted a couple of them down. So why... first answer you always get is, well, the intelligence community does all sorts of ugly stuff, right? And the answer to that is, well, of course, right? You know, but so do lots of other branches of the federal government. The federal government wields incredible coercive powers. It can threaten to kill you. And if the person who does that happens to be a, you know, in the context of the Justice Department or in the right context in the FBI, that is actually, you know, something we don't spend a lot of time, you know, fretting about. It can threaten to put you in a small box for the rest of your life. It can actually put you in a small box for the rest of your life. And yet, so the military, of course, conducts lethal force operations all over the world. And then that's before you get into lots of lesser exertions of authority, like the power to tax and the power to, you know, conduct all kinds of other things that impinge on people's liberties, and particularly depending on how one construes one's liberties, right? And so the fact that there is sort of ugly stuff done in the intelligence community is both true and utterly inadequate as an explanation for this kind of deep reservoir of suspicion. So then you say, well, okay, the other thing that you hear is, well, there's so much secrecy. And again, totally true. There's a lot of secrecy. Secrecy is corrosive of public trust. To believe that somebody's acting in good faith in secret is harder than to believe that somebody's acting in good faith not in secret. And particularly when you're doing ugly, scary things in secret, that kind of gets you to part of the explanation. But again, I think it doesn't get you to enough of the explanation. After all, a huge amount of what the government does is functionally secret, if only because nobody happens to FOIA it, or because it would be subject, if not classified, it would be subject to some FOIA exemption or another. And parts of the government that we in fact trust a great deal have huge levels of secrecy that we don't really mind all that much, or we kind of fight about the appropriate levels of secrecy, but we do it without developing a deep, deep suspicion of the day-to-day operations. The most trusted entity in U.S. public life is the military. The military conducts all kinds of operations with great secrecy, and we don't seem to say as a society, gee, the degree of day-to-day secrecy in the military is inconsistent with public trust in the institution. Another institution that we trust much more than we trust other institutions in American life is the U.S. Supreme Court. You can't FOIA the U.S. Supreme Court. Deliberations are, again, not classified, but there's a lot of secrecy there. They produce an opinion, and if you want to get the pre-decisional documents about those, you got to wait until a justice dies and happens to leave the material to the archive, the justice will designate, how many years before any of it becomes public. So secrecy is part of the explanation, but it's not an adequate explanation for the residual level of suspicion that leads to sort of very casual remarks like that. So I want to posit what I think is a deeper and more tectonic plate level reason for the suspicion. And I want to posit it very tentatively. I've honestly never given this speech before, and I've never floated this idea before. And so I would not be at all surprised if one of you gets up at one of those microphones and say, you're wrong, here's why. And I find myself saying, gee, that's probably right. But so consider this a tentative hypothesis. I think the Constitution and the rule of law-based society is premised on a set of neutral principles, premised on the idea of neutral principles. And the intelligence community, on a routine basis, uses non-neutral principles. And that is a kind of cognitive dissonance that people have a lot of trouble with. So let me unpack that a little bit. Premise of the rule of law, basic premise, is that the same conduct is either permitted or not permitted, neutrally, irrespective of what we happen to think of you. Free speech is free speech both for me and for the Ku Klux Klansmen. And when the law, rule of law societies, stop believing in neutral principles, that is very deeply corrosive of the rule of law. We internalize that in our fabric, the fabric of democratic life, just all the time, that the same rules apply, the same things apply, the same permissions apply to one group of people as apply to the other, as others. And the Constitution has moved much more emphatically in that direction, particularly over the last 150 years. It was very ambivalent about that, of course, prior to the abolition of slavery, prior to the advent of the Equal Protection Clause, and prior to the effectuation of those principles in the civil rights movement. In more recent years, when you articulate a set of principles that you want to make law on that aren't neutral as to whom you're talking to, those become very politically controversial. Think about disputes about campaign finance spending, right? Think about disputes about affirmative action, right? These are all areas where people complain, rightly or wrongly, that the same principles are not applying to one group of people as apply to the others, and this generates political controversy. And the reason it generates political controversy without expressing any view about the merits of those issues is that we deeply, deeply believe in the idea of the law as a neutral arbiter. Now, the intelligence community, I think, necessarily has an ambivalent relationship with this principle. We all believe in it as citizens, of course. On the other hand, imagine for a minute the Chinese analog to Edward Snowden. Now, I suspect I'm not the only person in this room who would be thrilled for there to be such a person. For somebody to say, go to Hong Kong and reveal all kinds of things, maybe not Hong Kong, but all kinds of things about the People's Liberation Army directly analogous to the stuff that was released about this agency. And I don't think I would look at that person and say, well, the same rules apply to, you know, their leaker as apply to our leaker. I would think I reserve the right as an American, as a believer in what you guys do, and as a non-believer in a lot of what the PLA does, and as somebody who has, without any more, you know, chauvinism than the next guy, much more solicitude for my own country than for the People's Republic of China, as an actor on the world stage. I think I would have I reserve the right, and I do, without feeling like a hypocrite, saying, I'm not pleased with what Edward Snowden did, and I'm thrilled with what hypothetical Chinese Edward Snowden did. Now, I will defend that stance, but I cannot defend that stance as a neutral principle, because it's not. So we routinely call people who cooperate with us agents, assets, heroes, people who cooperate from us, traitors, criminals. Neutral principles, that is not, right? There are a lot of activities that you guys do that are lawful that if I do are criminal acts. So General Hayden, in a very pithy phrase, I think, that became the title of Alex Gibney's wonderful movie about WikiLeaks, said to Alex Gibney, we steal secrets. You know, that's what we do. Now, I'm interested how many other former heads of agencies would use a word in describing what we do kind of cheerfully that under normal circumstances imputes criminal conduct, right? The other agency, you know, conducts lethal force operations. That's not something that I'm allowed to do, right? And there are all kinds of things that we rely on for their legitimacy, for you guys to do them, principles that aren't really very neutral. And I think this is, I'm not making any apologies for that, by the way. But I think it is the tectonic level of what gives rise to this very deep mistrust. And at a fairly politically, you know, and fairly politically pervasive across the spectrum. A friend of mine at CIA joked to me once that if it were legal under local law for us to do it, If it were legal under local law to do it, you wouldn't need to have a CIA. That's what the State Department is for. And I think, you know, that's an interesting statement about why we have clandestine intelligence services. And it's a little bit hard conceptually to reconcile, not impossible, but it's a little bit tricky to reconcile with the idea of constitutions based on neutral principles. So the question is there an answer to this problem? And I think the first answer is no, that one of the consequences, there's no complete answer to it. One of the consequences of having that tension and living with that tension is that we will always generate a certain level of mistrust for no matter how compliant with the law you are. And I go out and talk about all the time about people have no appreciation of the degree of the compliance record in an agency like this one. And there are basically two reactions to this. One is to think I'm being naive and silly. And the other is to say yes, but, right? And the yes, but is always followed with some complaint about the nature of the rules with which you all are complying on a day-to-day basis. I think that basic suspicion in which no matter how well you comply, the professor at the small liberal arts college is always going to say to the guy who says he's giving a Constitution Day speech at NSA, well, they really need it. That is not an ultimately resolvable tension. There are certain partial solutions. One of them is transparency. Now, there's this whole new gospel of transparency. I'm not a dissenter from it. But when I say transparency here, I don't mean it in quite the sense of document releases. I mean it in a different, more basic sense of candor and frankness about the basic tension. So the Japanese novelist Yukio Mishima, who eventually in 1969, this is to give you a sense of how extreme the conflicts in his own life were, eventually tried to stage a military coup in Japan and committed seppuku in public. He was a sort of extreme nationalist. Once said that the goal is not to live without contradictions, it's to be comfortable with your contradictions. So this is a man who was comfortable with his contradictions. And I think there's a lot to that, though I'm not far from an extreme Japanese nationalist. I think a certain candor and comfort level and directness about the basic tension. We are doing things that are different from what the average person would be or should be allowed to do. We're not going to make apologies for that. That's the reality. Is part of the answer. So I was in Germany recently talking. You want to have a fun weekend, go to Germany to talk about, you know, in public about, you know, the NSA. So I did it in Freiburg, and I really felt as I was doing it that I had an obligation to be as confrontational as I could, because you know, some of you may have noticed that the government's posture is occasionally somewhat apologetic. And I sort of felt like, well, I don't have any of those political constraints. And if I'm going to fly all the way to Freiburg, I'm going to, you know, to talk to a bunch of Germans about signals intelligence. I'm actually going to tell them exactly what I think, and I'm not going to make a lot of apologies for it. So I gave them a talk, the basic theme of which was just grow up. And I said to them at the beginning, you know, I've never flown this far to be as offensive as I'm going to be to such nice-looking people. And I feel like I should be standing here in a cowboy hat and big boots. But I want to tell you to, you know, just grow up. And so I gave a few examples. One was that at the height of the U.S.-Israel relationship, the Israelis ran an agent against us. As you know, Pollard is sentenced to life in prison. By most accounts, the take, what he disclosed to the Israelis was awful. And the aggregate effect on U.S.-Israel relationship over time was zero. Second example I gave was all this whining that happens in U.S. policy circles about Chinese cyber espionage. Now, many of you deal with that on a daily basis, I'm sure, at an operational level, which I don't. But my attitude toward people who whine about it, as though Chinese behavior is going to be conditioned by anything other than Chinese perceptions of Chinese strategic interests, is grow up. Our job may be to change their strategic calculation by raising the costs of their behavior. It may be to create defensive architectures that make it harder for them to do what we're doing, but there's no reason to whine about it. So what I said to the Germans was, look, I'm going to say exactly the same thing to you that I say to Americans who whine about what the Chinese do, which is just grow up. Now, I expected a totally hostile reaction to this, and I actually got an exceptionally warm reaction. Because it turns out that Europeans actually don't want to be treated like children. And so when I talk about transparency, I'm actually talking not just about transparency of documents, transparency of policies, transparency of law. I believe in all that stuff. But I'm also talking about transparency of values. There's a reason why we have this building. There's actually a lot of reasons why we have this building. And one of the things that I want to be transparent about is that I'm not very apologetic about that. And so I think, you know, one question is how we talk about that tension and how much we try to meet halfway or three-quarters of the way or 80% of the way about basic values that give rise to basic values, strategic needs, exigencies that give rise to certain operational assumptions and activities. The other much harder component of resolving this tension, and again, is not, I don't mean to say if you do these things, you'll resolve the tension. Because I think the professor at that dinner is probably always going to say they really need it. But there are these list of things, mostly related to technological development, that we need to think through prospectively, or begin thinking through prospectively, the relationship between doctrine and long settled doctrines and the realities of the world that we're going to be in. And I want to flag three of them as just requiring a lot of prospective thought. So I recently wrote a paper with a brilliant young law student named Jane Chong about what we call cyborgization, which is this question. You know, eight justices of the Supreme Court this year described the cell phone. John Roberts wrote, and seven justices signed, an opinion that has, in the very beginning, a description of the cell phone as something that is so, ubiquitous in its use in contemporary society. I think this is close to an exact quote, if not it, that the proverbial visitor of another planet from another planet would think this was a part of the human anatomy. Supreme Court said that in the course of saying you need a warrant in order to look at somebody's cell phone data when you seize it incident to an arrest. But if you look at it a different way, the Supreme Court just had 8 votes for the proposition that we're all partly cyborg. Now, a huge amount of what you guys do is legal because of the so-called third-party doctrine. And for those of you who aren't lawyers, third-party doctrine, which arises in the 1970s, which has gotten a lot of academic criticism, which I largely disagree with, says, okay, you can seize somebody's bank records without a warrant. You can seize somebody's telephone metadata without a warrant because these are records, non-content records, voluntarily given to a third party. One question that I've spent a lot of time thinking about over the last 18 months since the Snowden revelations is why people care about this stuff this much. When I started, you know, John was mentioned that I had been thinking about FISA for a long time and that I actually started writing about FISA in the, you know, mid-1990s. It was a mark of how uninterested the public was in those issues that when I got interested and sort of feveredly interested in these issues, I couldn't persuade my parents they were interesting. You know, and when you can't persuade your parents that you're not going off on a weird professional track, that shows how little public interest there was in these subjects. Now everybody cares. Everybody has an opinion about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They don't know what it's in it, but they really have an opinion about it. And you wonder, how did we go from a society in which we had a court in the Justice Department that, as John mentioned, when I was there as a young reporter, I was sitting around in the Justice Department and I asked, hey, can I see the FISA court? And they had never gotten a request like that. So they said kind of, sure. And they took me into the FISA court. You know, that wouldn't happen today, right? Because now we're a society that went from, over a very brief period of time, not really caring very much about the laws of signals intelligence and being comfortable with the basic rules that we've created for management of oversight, of regulation, of the conduct of what you guys do, to a society that is not comfortable with, cares a lot, and talks about it all the time. How did that happen? And I think the process of cyborgization is part of the answer to that. That, you know, in the early mid-90s, when I got interested in this, most people didn't have international communications. The architecture, the grid was not all integrated. To the extent that it was heading in that direction, people really hadn't noticed yet. And the proverbial visitor from another planet would see that if I wanted to talk to my wife while she's overseas, I had to go walk over to a phone, pick it up, dial it, and she had to walk over to a phone and pick it up and receive it. We weren't cyborgs then. Now, we don't notice so much the process of cyborgization because the chips, the phones, are not embedded in our skulls. But there are devices that are embedded in us, and they produce data too. Think about the pacemaker. Pacemaker produces all kinds of data. And that data is retrievable from the outside. And under the third-party doctrine, the cyborg whose heart is dependent on that device, which is producing data, is voluntarily giving that data to a third party. Now, I venture the proposition that if that were ever litigated, you know, if you guys ever decided, let's have a bulk pacemaker data program, right? I'm not suggesting it. Nobody would write the opinion that says, hey, there's this case, Smith v. Maryland, it's voluntarily given to a third party. Yeah, I know it was voluntarily given when the alternative was cardiac arrest, but, you know, you don't have to take a pacemaker, right? No one would write that, because the more integrated, the more essential for our human existences the cyborgization becomes, the less plausible the third party doctrine becomes. And I think what's driving the fear, what's driving the suspicion, is this belief. You know, we're all walking around with these phones that aren't yet implanted. But we're as integrated with them as we would be, or almost as integrated, if they were sitting there attached to our heads. And we fear that in this human-machine integration that we're creating and making more deep and more integrated every day, in this cyborg, one of the parties, the human party to the cyborg, has rights. The machine party does not have rights. The machine party is subject to surveillance. So when you create the cyborg, are you creating a human-machine entity with the rights of the machine? The more we go down that road, the more unsettled the doctrines that you guys rely on every day for your legal authorities are going to become. And I think it behooves any agency, not just you guys, but the Bureau, local police departments, any agency that has to exist in a data-driven world, and in a world in which you are interacting less and less with simple people and more with cyborgs, it behooves the agency to think about what the long-term doctrinal implications are going to be, and frankly should be, for very deep, deep human-machine integrations. Second issue that I think just requires prospective thought is the corrosive and deleterious effect for public confidence of what I call density. One of the problems, I speak about this stuff all the time, and one of the problems that I have when I do it is that not only is the law complicated, but that every proposal for reform proposes to make it more complicated. It is already so complicated that the normal citizen cannot possibly understand what you guys can and cannot do. They cannot possibly understand what is permitted and what is not permitted, what is not acquired, what's acquired but not collected, what's collected but then minimized. These are distinctions that you guys live and breathe every day. But the average person just wants to know whether you're spying on terrorists or whether you're spying on them. And the denser the rules get, the more we lose sight of the value of simplicity, the harder that gets. I spent, when I was at Kenyon, most of that dinner explaining rules. We didn't talk that much about whether the rules are right or not, because most of the time, you have to spend getting people to the point where they are even capable of having an opinion. That's corrosive. Now, all of this density takes place for really good reasons, which is we want to draw distinctions, right? We want to say, yes, you can do X in this situation, but boy, we don't want you to conduct X with respect to person Y or person Z. And then when we don't like the results, we add additional layers. And all of that is laudable. It's democracy in action. But it has a huge collateral consequence. And the collateral consequence is the utter inability of the citizen to understand what you guys do. And so I think there is a really important value that we can't lose sight of in the course of reform, which is a different side of transparency. It's simplicity, right? So this is very similar in many ways to the tax code argument, right? You guys are the tax code. And just as the tax code presents really an assumption that things must be really unfair because somebody's benefiting and I'm not, and I can't understand the rules, right? FISA's almost as complicated as the tax code. Finally, I'll end here. I do think we need prospectively to think very hard about what is going to replace the 1978 compromise, which has really collapsed and which people don't believe in anymore. Basic contours of the 1978 compromise, in my view, was three elements, right? Which is, number one, the borders of the United States really matter, and that you're allowed to do a whole lot of things beyond the borders of the United States that you're really not allowed to do within the borders of the United States. Add to that, of course, through subsequent amendment, that citizenship really, really matters. And then finally, and most importantly, that we can delegate to oversight mechanisms that don't operate in public, both in the congressional level, the executive level, and the judicial level, oversight responsibilities that with respect to other federal agencies, we insist take place in public, that we can create these proxy institutions. I think what the last 18 months have shown is that a very large swath of the society, a growing swath on both the political right and the political left, it is not a voting majority of either house, but give it some time, don't believe that particularly with respect to that last element, that the secret accountability mechanisms have integrity. And as somebody who does believe that they have integrity, that's a very upsetting thing to me. But I observe that it is a reality. You know, when I go out and speak about the way you guys operate and the way the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court operates and the way the oversight mechanisms that are in place function, the compliance regimes that are in place function, I don't get a whole lot of head nodding agreement. I'm a much less popular person than I was 18 months ago, right? And the reason is that I have defended the 1978 compromise and it doesn't have the constituency that it used to have. So I think we need to think about what if, and that's before you get to the overseas complaint, right, which is that I don't believe in any compromise that is based on the distinction between U.S. persons and non-U.S. persons. So what if that compromise, that the basic contours of what we did in 1978 are not stable? I think requires a lot of prospective thought to imagine what comes next. I don't have an answer to that question, by the way, or any of those three questions. I sort of lay them out as challenges that I think if we are going to temper the instinct of very bright people to say when somebody like me says, hey, I'm going to go give the Constitution Day speech at NSA, says, yeah, they really need it. If we're going to temper that, those are three really big questions we're going to have to take on over the next months, years, decades. Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And if you enjoy the Lawfare podcast, please take a moment to spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast on your social networks. We'll greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.